Welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Jay Butler, your host today. Childhood trauma has been associated with lifelong health effects, and we've had a number of programs where we've discussed the effects of childhood trauma, but today we'd like to talk about not only the effects, health effects of childhood trauma, but also what can be done. So I have two guests this morning from Alaska Cares. I have Hillary Walker. Hillary is a mental health therapist with Alaska Cares. She has a master's degree in counseling psychology from Alaska Pacific University, and she specializes in training in healing trauma and abuse. With her is Dr. Kathy Baldwin Johnson, a board-certified family physician and lifelong Alaskan and medical director at Alaska Cares. Kathy trained at the University of Washington School of Medicine and the Swedish Hospital Family Practice Residency. So Hillary, Kathy, welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection.
Thank you.
So let's start with some definitions. We talked about the program in terms of childhood trauma. Trauma is one of those terms in medicine we use in a number of different contexts. I know trauma surgeons, they deal with catastrophic accidents and injuries. What kind of trauma are we talking about?
In this case, we're talking about bad experiences that children have when they don't have adequate supports to deal with those experiences. So those are things like sexual abuse, physical abuse, neglect of a child's basic needs, or exposure to different kinds of household dysfunction, like family members going to prison, family members that have a mental illness, substance abuse in the home, things like that.
Okay.
So when I hear the word trauma, I'm thinking a scary or disturbing thing that happens to us that overwhelms our ability to cope. So I'm really thinking about what happens in the brain during that experience. So we're often overwhelmed by panic or terror. There's intense physiological arousal in our nervous system. And so I really think, like, what's happening in the body? What's happening in the nervous system? Often our prefrontal cortex, that front part of our brain, is shutting off, and we're relying on these survival strategies. So fighting back, fleeing, freezing. If none of those work, we might shut down entirely, numb out. So it can be a really complex process, and really thinking about, you know, how are those memories stored in the brain?
So trauma is really when adults do scary things, and there's not an adult to kind of provide that comfort or that buffering that every child needs. Hillary, you talked about the effects on the brain. Toxic stress is a term that I've heard increasingly in recent years. What is toxic stress?
So my definition of toxic stress would be when a child is exposed to stress over a long period of time. It's really chronic. So that stress response is on pretty much all the time. So the body is flooded with those stress hormones. Cortisol is one of those. And there's nobody providing a safe holding environment. There's no comfort, support. And over time, it really gives the body a lot of wear and tear. And it also impacts the very development of the brain. We know the brain in young children develops in a caring environment, so in the context of those relationships with parents, caregivers. And so if you don't really get that, if your parent is absent or not supportive or impaired in some way, or if something catastrophic happens, your brain, the back part, is not going to be connecting to the front part. The neural networks are just not growing in a healthy way. And so it really sets us up for a lifetime of challenge and more difficulty in school and work and relationships and so on.
So that stress response is really intended to protect us.
Exactly.
The flight or fight or freeze phenomenon. And I think all of us have experienced that when we're outside and unexpectedly run into a bear or a moose is actually towering over us. And that response can sometimes help us. But if it's like you're constantly living with the bear, that's going to take a toll.
Exactly. Yeah, it really messes up our body chemistry. So when our brain is shutting down in that way, when our cortex is not online and we're using that limbic system, that emotional kind of primitive part of the brain, that's a really good thing. It is keeping us alive. And so we want to honor that. But when it's happening, at school, you can't learn. When it's happening on the playground, you're going to be getting into fights. It really is damaging for kiddos.
So we're really talking about normal kids who have been through extraordinary circumstances and have had the effects of those extraordinary circumstances have been manifest in the brain and other parts of the body because that stress response is sort of just ongoing. It never calms down again.
Yeah, so I say post-traumatic stress is a normal reaction to an abnormal event. So it's exactly what our body is supposed to do. It keeps us alive in those survival situations.
All right. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm talking today with Dr. Kathy Baldwin Johnson and Hillary Walker from Alaska Cares. We're talking about childhood trauma. We'd welcome you to join the conversation by calling us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752. You can also contact us by email at lineone@alaskapublic.org. If you're listening to the taped rebroadcast or you're streaming from the web, or have I mentioned the AK app lately? The AK app is an excellent way to catch up on any missed episodes. Well, of course, we can't take your questions on the air, but if you want to email us any questions, I will promise that we'll try to connect you with people and get some answers to you. So, how common is childhood trauma in Alaska?
It's actually very common. I think folks are aware of the fact that Alaska, for many, many years, has ranked as one of the top in the nation in terms of rates of child maltreatment, as well as other forms of family violence. There's actually been a study looking at those adverse childhood experiences in Alaskan adults, and two-thirds of Alaskan adults have had at least one of these categories of bad things that happened to them when they were children. So there's definitely an impact on our state and on the health of our state.
Right. And as before we came on the air, we were talking about a report that came out of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention earlier this week. Dr. Melissa Merrick reported from the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance Survey, or BRFSS, that looked at 23 states, the prevalence of ACEs among adults. And nationally, 3 out of 5 adults had at least one adverse childhood experience, and 25% had 3 or more. So our numbers are worse than the national averages, but unfortunately they're pretty concerning really all across our country, aren't they?
Yes, they sure are.
So the health effects of childhood trauma, I want to, you know, return to the effects on the child later in the discussion and what can be done. But let's talk about those lifelong effects of the chronic toxic stress reaction. What are some of the health effects of that?
Well, when that original adverse childhood experiences study was conducted as a collaboration through the Centers for Disease Control and Kaiser Permanente, what they found in these adults was that the higher that adverse childhood experiences score, so the higher of the number of these 10 categories of abuse, neglect, and family dysfunction that people had, the more likely they were to have all of the most common causes of adult disease and disability in our country today. So that included heart disease. So actually, someone's ACE score was a better predictor of their risk for heart disease than the traditional risk factors that I was taught as a family doctor to ask about. In addition, all forms of cancer, diabetes, hypertension, interesting things like even your risk of having osteoporosis-related fractures as an adult. And then certainly it was related to the higher the ACE score, the more likely people were to be engaging in higher risk health behaviors. So things like smoking and drinking, using drugs, and even things like being a couch potato. So a high ACE score was also linked to having a sedentary lifestyle.
One of the things I found very interesting about this, the evolving science in this, is that ACEs are a risk factor for risk factors, but because of the toxic stress reaction, they are also in and of themselves contributory to risk factors such as heart disease. To put it another way, as I've seen some of the more in-depth analyses, as the numbers get bigger, taking two non-smokers, the one with a high ACE score is going to be at higher risk of heart disease later in life than the one with an ACE score of zero or one.
Yeah, when the ACE study was first published, I think people's initial analysis was that what happened is these bad things happened in childhood. People had this impact on their brain development. They ended up making lifestyle choices that then increased their risk for these adverse health outcomes, and that was why people were getting sick with all of these diseases and dying younger. But then they discovered, oh no, there are people that have never been smokers, never been drinkers, they're marathon runners, they live a very healthy lifestyle, and they still have a higher risk of all of these diseases and a higher risk of dying younger than somebody who has an ACE score of zero.
Okay. So just thinking through that issue of risk factors for risk factors, I'll have to confess my response when the initial ACE score came out with Dr. Anda and Dr. Faletti. I thought these are really compelling data, but it's too bad we can't do anything about it. So I think I've moved beyond that. I think the science has moved beyond that. But just at the high level, what do we do about that?
I think, and I'll let Hillary talk a little bit more about what we can do when kids are young. But I think for me as a family doctor, what was important was realizing that I could help my adolescent and adult patients kind of reframe the experiences that they had. So it became a matter of not what's wrong with you, but what happened to you, and helping them to understand some of the science behind why they were making the decisions they were making and why they had the illnesses that they had. I think it really helped people to be more receptive to getting the kind of help that they needed as an adult. So I always felt that it didn't matter where in the lifespan somebody was, we could always make a difference in their health and how they felt about themselves.
Okay. I'd like to take a caller. Amelia has questions about eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. Hillary, that question has your name written all over it. Amelia, welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection.
Hello, thank you. This topic's near and dear to me. Childhood trauma. I'm rounding on 40 now, but I had childhood trauma. Bullied pretty badly at school, physically, mentally. And then some addiction in the home. I was able to avoid making poor life choices and have done well for myself. But there's always been that cloud hanging over my head. And I've just started researching and started receiving EMDR treatment. And I know there's a lot of research about immediately after, like with veterans and the sort. But I'm wondering what you found with childhood trauma and addressing it via adult many decades later.
Well, thanks so much for the question. I really commend you for reaching out and getting some support for those traumatic experiences you've gone through. EMDR is a really well-validated treatment modality. We use it with kiddos right after traumatic events, and it also has great effectiveness with adults who have suffered childhood trauma, whether that is in the context of their families or school or a natural disaster. So what EMDR is doing is it's jump-starting the brain's natural healing capacity. So in trauma, what happens is the memory often gets kind of frozen or stuck in the nervous system. It's just too big for our brain to naturally heal. And so EMDR jump-starts that process, and it helps the nervous system process out the memories to reduce the emotional charge. So it's not about reducing or erasing the memory, rather, but reducing the emotional impact. So it sounds like you're on a really good path.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I've tried prescription drugs, and I find that just even to start, it's It's quite effective. I'm quite shocked.
So happy to hear that.
Yes. Thank you for the call. Amelia. So Amelia brings up a couple of, I think, important points. First of all, for people with a high ACE score, it's not a deterministic issue that you're going to have poor health outcomes. There are people who do very well with high ACE scores, and there are interventions that are available. It's a risk factor. It's not a direct cause and effect. If this, then this. The other that I think we didn't discuss yet that I think is important to highlight is that trauma comes in a lot of different packages. And a child or an adult who has had a high ACE score may come from a very stable family with two loving parents in the home. So this is not meant in any way to put a guilt trip on parents as well. And in fact, children from stable homes sometimes are victimized, and that's, I think, underappreciated. And when abuse is identified, the loved ones are often shocked. It seems that there's often a sense that in talking with parents, they'll oftentimes say, I had a sense something was amiss, but I couldn't quite put my finger on it. What are the red flags that parents and guardians should be looking for?
Certainly kids that have significant changes in their behaviors. So, for example, a child who's been doing well in school who now is failing their classes, a child who's all of a sudden engaging in risky behaviors, a child who's having physical symptoms that could indicate sexual abuse. Certainly anytime a child makes any sort of disclosure, then I think that needs to be taken very seriously. Parents, caregivers, teachers, coaches, they need to listen for that, and the initial response needs to be to believe that child and respond appropriately to that situation.
All right. This is a medical show. We like to keep our rating in the PG-13 range. You mentioned physical symptoms. What might those be?
So there's no one physical symptom that's absolutely diagnostic for example, sexual abuse, but kids that are having recurrent urinary tract infection kind of symptoms, it's not that bladder infections are diagnostic, but kids that keep having those kinds of symptoms, kids that are certainly having any bleeding or itching or chronic belly pain, chronic pelvic pain, those are some of the physical symptoms that some kids might present with.
So we've spent some time, particularly when the Surgeon General was on the show back in August, and of course the Surgeon General is an anesthesiologist by training, talking about pain. We oftentimes don't recognize that pain is a subjective experience, and yes, there can be pathology that's reflected, but it sounds like you're suggesting that also pain can be an effect of psychological factors, as well as an outcome of toxic stress as well.
Mm-hmm. So what I would encourage parents to do is create a space where you can talk about feelings and tune into those differences, those changes in behavior, like Dr. Kathy said. If someone was doing well in school and all of a sudden they aren't, be really curious about that and create a safe environment. I also encourage parents to teach kids the appropriate language for body parts, you know, what a doctor would use. And also empower kids to say, like, no, this touch feels bad, even if it's a hug from aunt or uncle, you know, really teaching them those healthy boundaries early on.
Okay. We are going to go to a break for the stations down the line. I'm Dr. Jay Butler, your host today. This is Line 1, Your Health Connection, talking with Dr. Kathy Johnson and Hillary Walker about the effects of childhood trauma. We'll be back in a minute.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org. Lead is bad for the health of Alaskans, especially for young children. It affects developing brains, so even small amounts are unsafe. Lead can be hiding in older paint, workplaces, ammunition, fishing weights, aviation gas, and marine paint. If you think you or your child has been exposed, ask a healthcare provider about testing. Get the lead out, Alaska. Learn more at leadfree.dhss.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Jay Butler, your host for today. We're talking with Dr. Kathy Baldwin-Johnson of the Alaska CARES program, as well as Hillary Walker, about childhood trauma and what can be done about it. So we have a question that came in by email. Could you speak to a child when exposed to adverse childhood experiences regarding development of self-regulation skills? This would be the ability to self-regulate under stress, and also self-regulation skills as how do you teach that and coach that as a strategy to address children with adverse childhood experiences?
Well, this is a great question, and it's one of the first things we address in therapy. And as a caveat, I am a mental health therapist, but I'm not your therapist. So everything I'm going to be saying, you know, get professional help if you think it would be helpful and important. But like I said, that trauma, especially chronic trauma, impacts those connections in the brain. So self-regulation is all about the front of the brain connecting to that limbic system, the emotional part, and being able to use executive functioning, understand cause and effect, impulse control, all of those things. And so if you have a lot of trauma, those connections just aren't really robust. And so the good thing is we can practice and learn those skills. Mindfulness is a great way. I look a lot at what's happening in the nervous system. So if someone is going really fast into fight, flight, or freeze, we need to build those skills to help them come back down into the window of tolerance, to a place where they can deal with the stress that they're facing. So I use a lot of body-based interventions, somatic things. Breathing is a great way. Using your five senses to get in the present moment. So looking around and saying, what are five things that I can see in the room? What are four things I can hear, really using those senses. We're always trying to create a space between reacting and responding. So something happens to you, there's a trigger, but creating a space so you don't have to do that automatic trauma response of whacking your neighbor or screaming or running away, you can respond in a different way. And it takes time. And the great news is the more we practice it, the better we're going to be.
So let's talk about breathing, because we're not talking about a cardiopulmonary problem. I had to laugh when Chris Pratt accepted his MTV award, and his first piece of advice to the younger generation was, just breathe. If you don't, you'll asphyxiate. Good tongue-in-cheek humor, I'll say. But there's more to it than that. So I hear that frequently, and sometimes you see even little signs that says, just breathe.
Don't want to be hyperventilating or breathing in a really shallow, fast way. That's actually going to increase our stress response. So we want to just slow down the breath. Some people call it a belly breath, so really extending your belly, drawing in the air really slowly, exhaling really slowly. And it takes practice. You know, this isn't a sure fix. It can be even triggering for some people when they start.
So it's almost like a timeout, it seems like, chance to say, stop, I can be under control here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. We really want to get that prefrontal cortex back online, engaged.
So in the discussions about the connection between the prefrontal cortex and the limbic system, this is very reminiscent of what we've learned about addiction and the effect of multiple drugs, particularly those that release dopamine in the limbic system of the brain, and how the executive function driven by the prefrontal cortex is overridden by the desire to get that dopamine surge in the brain. Am I off base on this? Is there some analogies in terms of what's going on in terms of when the part of the brain that should be in charge is getting overridden?
Sure, yeah. You're definitely onto something there. If you think about different drugs, some of them send us up and some of us bring us down. And so we're almost like regulating ourselves in this unhealthy way. I see a lot of people who suffer from addiction or substance abuse problems. They often have a history of trauma. In fact, if you look at the ACEs numbers, if you have four or more, you're 10 times more likely to use injection drugs and 7 times more likely to be an alcoholic. And my theory is that if you have trauma and you don't have that good connection in your brain for the self-regulation, you're going to look to other things to regulate your experience.
Okay.
I think one of the most impactful things for me the first time I heard Dr. Felitti speak about this was to realize that when my patients were making these unhealthy choices, like using drugs, to realize that that was really their solution to their problems. And so it became my job to recognize the positives there, that this really was, these were coping mechanisms, and to help them figure out healthier ways to take care of their stress and to take care of their health.
So in a very real sense, it's self-medication. It's trying to find relief from that ongoing stress.
Absolutely.
Okay. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm speaking today with Hillary Walker from Alaska Cares and Dr. Kathy Baldwin-Johnson. We welcome you to join the conversation. Call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752. You can also contact us by email at line1@alaskapublic.org. We have a caller. I want to move into more details about Alaska Cares. We have Gunnar from Fairbanks. I have the feeling this is an old friend. So Gunnar, welcome to Line 1, Your Health Connection. And thank you to KUAC for carrying Line 1, Your Health Connection.
Yeah. Hi, Dr. Butler and guests. So this is... So I'm Gunnar Ebbesen. I own a trauma center who happens to work on substance use disorders and mental health in Fairbanks, Alaska. And I'm really super grateful for the guests you have on today. My opinion about what they're talking about is that they get it. The understanding the body-based treatments, understanding reprocessing therapies that focus on so reprocessing memories using the midbrain instead of trying to reprocess memories using frontal cortex, which, although there's research to support it, I think that it's very challenging, and some of these things are like prolonged exposure therapy. And so I had a couple comments. One is, you know, I really agree. One of the sort of taglines that I use is around ACEs, is that ACEs is not a destiny, but it's an opportunity for intervention. And I think the research supports that, like you said. And so really how we can work in the public health sector and in schools is by, you know, really determining what kiddos are experiencing trauma and then referring them to the appropriate treatment. And, you know, in my opinion, it's those kinds of treatments like EMDR. I'm a trainer for brain spotting, which is a upcoming trauma reprocessing intervention. Also has a lot of research support for it. But not just the reprocessing therapies, you know, things like trauma center, trauma sensitive yoga, trauma informed massage, equine therapy, canine therapy, all these things that go directly at midbrain. You know, and also that they're stepwise. One of my concerns in our state is, and I'll just say this, is that a lot or most of our adolescent treatment centers that are inpatient, despite the incredible high rate of trauma in our state, don't have these therapies. And so I'm using this opportunity to inform parents to make sure that when you have a kiddo that you know has experienced trauma, that you get them into the kind of care that's going to long-term, you know, help fix what happened. help them to reprocess and think about what happened to them in terms of like it's just part of their story, and that they can survive it and they can thrive from it. And I'll take my comments offline, or your comments offline. Thanks.
All right. Thank you for calling line one, Gunnar. So thoughts?
I absolutely agree. And I think, you know, one of the most important things that we do at CARES is to be able to get kids and their families starting on that healing path with the appropriate therapies. We offer that both on site through Hillary, as well as through referrals with people that have had that specific trauma-focused kind of training.
Okay. So let's talk about Alaska CARES. Alaska CARES is the Child Advocacy Center at Providence Children's Hospital. Child Advocacy Center is actually a proper noun in a sense. So let's start with, what is a Child Advocacy Center?
So a Child Advocacy Center is a place where all of the different representatives from all the different agencies that are involved with cases of suspected child abuse or neglect come together to bring all of their resources to the child and family. In the old days, and I've been around long enough to remember those days, when there was a concern, then a child and their family would have to go to the Child Protection Agency and tell their story. They'd have to go to the police station where the child might be interviewed in the same room where they interview suspects. Then they might go to a doctor's office or to the emergency room where they were being examined by somebody who didn't really know, you know, what they were doing. And then they were going maybe to then to a counselor's office or a therapist's office where they were having to tell that story all over again. So kids were telling their stories multiple times. And a lot of times getting sort of lost in that shuffle, they and their families. So what happens with a child advocacy center is the child and their parents, if there's a protective parent, come to the child advocacy center. If it's a case that involves the Office of Children's Services, which is our child protection agency in Alaska, then there'll be a caseworker from the Office of Children's Services there. If it involves a possible crime against a child, then somebody from law enforcement, a detective, for example, from the Crimes Against Children Unit, from the Anchorage Police Department might be there. We'll have some of our Alaska CARES staff, which will include somebody to provide the medical aspect of that. So besides myself, we have a team of nurse practitioners and a forensic nurse that will sit in on that appointment. We have advocacy services both from Alaska CARES staff, as well as we have advocacy services provided through South Central Foundation for Alaska Native families. And we all sit down together and we talk about the concern. And then the child is, if they're old enough to talk, they're forensically interviewed by somebody that has specialized training in talking to kids about really difficult issues. If it's indicated, they have an exam done by a medical provider who is specifically trained in how to do a medical exam for kids that may have been abused or severely neglected. And then we all sit down together again and figure out what it is that this child needs. And that often includes referral for the child and or their parents to a therapist with specific trauma training like Hillary.
Well, so a lot has changed over the past few decades. I remember a time when the medical system basically re-traumatized children. Certainly when I did my training, it was usually the intern's job to do the medical evaluations and instances of abuse. And it wasn't that it was being dumped on the interns. It was just recognized that they would probably end up being witnesses in a court case, and they were the ones who were most likely to still be in town a couple of years down the road. But there was really minimal specialty training in how to do that. And it was kind of recognized as one of those things that you had to do as a healthcare provider, but it wasn't recognized how important it was. So that is just very gratifying to hear that we've made that kind of progress over the past 30 years. Nonetheless, it's a traumatic experience, and you mentioned forensic interview. Tell us a little more about that. And I'm remembering, again, that was about 30 years ago that I was doing this kind of thing. And at that time, we were dealing with the issue that electronic pornography was a new thing. That through cable TV or through VCRs, this was before DVDs, sometimes very young children were being exposed to pornography and had a degree of sophistication that a 3 or 4 year old shouldn't have. And it made those interviews very difficult. Again, this is an area where I know there's been a lot of progress. So tell us a little more about how that would be done nowadays.
So the forensic interview is a structured discussion with the child with open-ended questions because we don't want to lead the child into saying things that aren't true or suggest things to a child because a lot of times kids are, they really want to be pleasers. So they'll, you know, try to give an answer that they think that grown-up wants. Alaska has a specific protocol. It's a nationally recognized protocol that's used for forensic interview training. And in order for somebody to do a forensic interview at CARES, they need to have this specialized training. And certainly, you know, you mentioned that potential exposure to pornography as a reason for things a child might say or behaviors a child might have. That's certainly part of that forensic interview protocol. That's part of the differential diagnosis, basically. It's something to consider nowadays, and especially because that exposure is unfortunately so easy anymore for kids to run across.
Okay. So when a child comes into your care, and I recognize the kids come in from all kinds of backgrounds with all kinds of experiences, what's kind of the general process that then happens? How do you approach this child as given the role that you have as a caregiver?
As I said, when the family comes, then the team will sit down initially with the parent and just talk about the concern to find out. Sometimes it's a surprise to this parent, so there's a lot of support that's needed for that parent because they weren't aware that something was happening to their child. We get medical history from the parent and later on additional history from the child. The child, as I said, has a forensic interview from somebody trained to talk to them. They have a medical evaluation, and then there's an assessment made of what other kinds of services besides mental health services. Sometimes there's a, you know, maybe it's a referral to the food bank, or, you know, sometimes it's just really basic needs that parents and children have. Sometimes it's the parent may need their own therapy. Sometimes the parent may need a referral to the domestic violence shelter. So there's a whole host of other issues often going on with the family that we help them to address so that they can protect their child from harm in the future.
Who can receive services from Alaska CARES?
Anyone can receive services from CARES. The majority of our referrals come from either law enforcement or the Office of Children's Services. We do end up receiving referrals from some medical providers in the community that may see something on an exam that they're not sure about. But the majority of our referrals are from law enforcement or the Office of Children's Services. And their referrals are coming from a whole host of different places. This may be the school district, could be healthcare providers. Those are probably the two most common sources of referrals to them.
Okay. So how is Alaska CARE supported? Do I need money or insurance for my child to receive care?
We don't bill families directly ever for any of the services that we provide. So everything that we do, families don't have to worry about being charged for that.
Okay, great.
And that includes the mental health therapy, too. So all of that is free of charge for families.
All right. Well, we need to go to a break for the stations down the line. I'm Dr. Jay Butler, your host today. This is Line 1, your health connection. We'll be back in a minute.
Funding for Line One, Your Health Connection, was made possible in part by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and listeners just like you. Thank you.
Hello, and welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host today, Dr. Jay Butler, and my guests are Hillary Walker and Dr. Kathy Baldwin-Johnson from Alaska Cares. And we're talking about the effects of childhood trauma and also taking care of children who've experienced trauma. If you'd like to join the conversation, you're welcome to give us a call live on the air at 1-888-353-5752. That's toll-free statewide. Or drop us an email at line1@alaskapublic.org. And we have a question from Emily that's come in by email. Emily says she'd like to hear about the ability to revisit and treat childhood trauma once a person has reached adulthood. Are persons with addictions and destructive tendencies as adults too far out of their trauma to revisit and treat the trauma? And is there any advice from you guys on how to approach this subject with an adult who may not realize that their trauma is still affecting them? Wow, critical question.
Yeah, great question. So first of all, it's never too late. Our brains are constantly changing. That's why therapy works. We can create new associations and new learning. So it's never, never too late. So I really want to offer that word of encouragement. Even if it has been 20, 30, 40 years, you can change the way that old event, that old trauma is impacting you today. And that's what trauma is really about. It's not just a bad thing that happened to you. In a sense, it keeps happening because it keeps intruding, and sometimes we're not even aware of it. So as far as addressing it with someone who might not realize, I think creating trauma-informed systems, talking about how trauma impacts our behavior, our emotions, our mental health, our physical health, creating more awareness, and then really offering the option, like, maybe this is about something that happened to you, not what is wrong with you, not this bad destructive behavior, but something in your history. And not everyone is open to it, and not everyone wants to revisit those memories too.
Right. It seems like it's really for the person to decide when it's time to come forward.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. So we've talked about I think Emily's question is important and touches on how we have discussed that childhood trauma can influence health outcomes as adults and how we interact with the world. How is childhood trauma different from trauma experienced in adulthood?
Well, first of all, adults have more resources, both internally with their coping skills and externally. They have more options. If they're in an abusive relationship, they can leave. Kids, if they're being abused at home, they really can't do that. And so kids have fewer resources and they rely more on the adults around them for that support. So the good news is if a kiddo goes through a relatively contained or single incident trauma, because their brains are still developing, the healing goes pretty fast. The trouble is when kids get into that complex trauma area where they have trauma layered on top of trauma and it goes on for a long time, that can be much harder to treat. So it's a pretty complex question. If you're a healthy adult and go through something traumatic, that's pretty easy to resolve. Usually, if it's a single incident trauma in childhood, that can be easy. But everyone's different, and there are a lot of different factors that go into this.
Well, I've heard the term ACCCEs. I'll attribute it to Liz Medicine Crow because she was the first one that mentioned it to me, but acknowledging that there is childhood, community, and cultural trauma, and all of which may contribute to one another and have overlays. So it's important to think, you know, right now on the East Coast, there's sort of massive trauma from the hurricanes, that children have very specific needs in a situation like that. Fortunately, we haven't had any large natural disasters in Alaska in a while, but I'm curious sort of how you see that community response in a mass event, how that may differ for kids.
Well, if there's a community event where adults are also being traumatized, they might not be as available or as supportive to tend to those children. I also think about cultural issues, you know, genocide, racism, things like that. We're still dealing with microaggressions, and we know that that triggers a stress response in the body. So growing up in a culture where you might be a member of a group that is put down or discriminated against, that is a form of stress and trauma, too.
Okay. I'd like to take another caller. Caroline, welcome to Line 1, Your Health Connection.
Yes, good morning. There's so much to be covered in this, and I was glad to hear you get into the cultural dysfunction. One of the things that I've been happy to hear about is the study of epigenetics and the way of transferring things, because many times parents are just adult children suffering from what was done to them. And that is something which, you know, the money that it costs us, not just immediately to try and help fix families, as it were, and cultures, but also the lost potential of every human being able to function without fear. Let me mention three quick things. Number one, we don't lose as many children to disease as we did before we got modern medicine. And I think that when children were precious, they were treated with a great deal more care. And families helped each other. We do very little training for families, for parents, that of course may be just responding to what was done to them. But two quick things. I was told many, many years ago, I was having a wonderful chance to travel throughout Alaska, and one Inupiaq elder said to me, "We don't raise our children as you folks do. We are not as hard on our children because life is hard." And the other thing I heard, and I don't know how to verify it, was that the Plains Indians, and this would have been back in the 1830s, 60s, whatever, whenever the expansion went west, referred to the whites coming across the plains as the people who beat their children. So again, this is not new. It is stronger in some cultures, perhaps, than in others, and it is an epidemic now, which has to be dealt with, because we have so many children coming into the school system, which is a stressor to begin with severe and say two out of six of the childhood traumas. So we need to strongly address this, because it's costing us a tremendous amount in lost potential to this culture.
Well, thank you, Caroline. So the economic impact of childhood trauma, Kathy or Hillary, any comments there? I see Kathy has a document she's referring to.
Yeah, there actually is a study that was done called The Economic Costs of Adverse Childhood Experiences in Alaska, and it was done through the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse and the American Mental Health Board. As we talked about, often substance abuse is a coping mechanism for childhood trauma. And they looked at the costs of just six particular items that impact health in Alaska, and our economy in Alaska. So they looked at the costs related to people who are on Medicaid, people who are current smokers, people who have diabetes, people who are binge drinkers, people who have arthritis, and people who are obese. And they looked at the costs of people who have these high ACE scores and have those health factors. And they said if we could decrease our burden of adverse childhood experiences here in the state of Alaska, we could save the state of Alaska $92 million a year, which adds up to real money when you start looking at, and that's just those six items. That doesn't include you know, cancers and heart disease and all of the other health impacts related to adverse childhood experiences.
Dr. Baldwin-Johnson, I'm going to ask you the tough question I always ask when we're talking about economic analyses. Who saves that money? You know, oftentimes economic analyses are done from a societal perspective, and it's a little harder to know what does that mean in terms of the state budget, or if I'm president of BP, what does it mean to my bottom line, or if I'm a small business owner? Do the data get that granular? I mean, I'll just throw out an example. Do we have an estimate of the cost savings to Alaska Medicaid?
Yeah, they estimate the cost savings to Alaska Medicaid is close to $40 million a year if we were able to reduce our ACEs burden. So again, you know, this it starts adding up very, very quickly.
Yeah. $100 million there, $100 million there. Pretty soon we're talking about real money.
Yeah.
I think it was Everett Dirksen. I'm sure a caller is going to call in and correct me. But so let's talk about then what we do. You know, we've talked about the challenges of childhood trauma. We've talked about the good work you do at Alaska Cares to mitigate the effects when childhood trauma occurs. Let's talk more about prevention and kind of that community level intervention in terms of building resilience. What do we do? I guess this is still a bit of the mitigation discussion, but for children who have experienced trauma, whether it's personal or community or cultural trauma, how do we build resilience?
Well, if listeners take one thing from this program that I say, it would be this. Social support is the number one protective factor and healing factor. So having those strong relationships, believing children when they confide in us, giving them patience and support, creating a safe environment, keeping up those healthy routines, taking care of our bodies, so sleeping well, eating well, exercising. But social support, number one, whether it's kiddos or adults, we know that that is the most protective factor.
And I always let people know when I give presentations in the community that every one of us has the capacity to be that one person in a child's life that they know that they can always go to and that will always be there for them. And as Hillary said, that's one of the most important protective factors and one of the biggest contributors to resilience for kids.
Okay. And I want to remind callers that we have a whole slew of web-based information available on the Line One website. If you're not familiar with the website, if you just Google Line One Your Health Connection, you'll get a connection to the show's website. If you click on the link to today's show, you'll then get a number of links related to some background information on childhood trauma, but also resilience, including some of the work by San Francisco pediatrician Nadine Burke-Harris, whose work has been highlighted in a one-hour film made by James Redfort. That's a familiar name among film producers, entitled Resilience, The Biology of Stress and the Science of Hope. And I understand that that will be screened at the Beartooth in Anchorage at 5:30 on Monday, November 5th. So I want to make people aware of that. And on the website, you can find the trailer for that film and learn more about the work that's being done to build resilience. This morning, we probably don't have as many live listeners from the education community. The Department of Education is actually hosting a summit on school safety and well-being. This really relates to what they're talking about at their summit right now. So I'd like to ask you, what would you like to say to educators?
Well, what I would say is being aware of the impact of trauma on behavior and also on learning. Like we talked about the brain earlier, if your brain, if the front part is shut off, you're not going to be able to learn those fractions or those word problems or write an essay. You're in survival mode. And so just being really aware, there's a lot of things we can do in our classrooms to make them more trauma-informed, educating kids and teachers, creating safe, quiet spaces, being aware of how triggers work and how to get the body back into that window of tolerance, doing somatic things. I know those fidget spinners were really popular a while ago, and then I think they caused some problems in school and were distracting. But, you know, giving kids the opportunity to have something to squeeze or to take a break, or tailoring different interventions to them so they can do that during the school day is really important. And also, teachers can be that one person, like we talked about. Even if you have gone through tremendous abuse and trauma as a child, having that one supportive adult who looks at you with those kind eyes, we really learn about ourselves by the way adults look at us and treat us. So having that safe, positive connection, it's priceless.
So you mentioned the important role of connectivity and community in building resilience. The past 2 weeks, my co-host Prentice Pemberton has highlighted some of the issues surrounding screen time and the use of wireless devices. Is that connectivity? Is it isolation? In the 21st century, is there such a thing as virtual connectivity?
Frankly, I don't think we know the answer to that question yet. We're going to see the results in 15, 20 years. So I know a lot of adolescents, it's a lot easier for them to text a friend than talk face to face, especially about that tough stuff. These days, we also have texting therapy available. We have texting crisis lines. So I'm not writing it off. I do think, though, that when we are spending a lot of time with those screens and those devices, we aren't building the same type of connections face-to-face. And what's really important, I think, is for parents to be aware of how are they using their cell phones and tablets when they're around their infants, toddlers, kiddos. They really need to be present and be engaging. That eye contact, that mirroring, it's really important. That's how kids develop.
Okay, great. We have about a minute left. So each of you, I'll give you each 30 seconds. What do you think are the take-homes today?
I think probably the most important thing is that, you know, we can't prevent trauma for all children, unfortunately, but we can make a difference. And as you said, ACEs are risk factors, but they're not the final determinant. And I think it's always possible to change the trajectory of somebody's life and their health with the right kind of intervention.
Yes, I think our caller today, Gunnar Ebbesen, said it well. ACEs are not a destiny. Hillary?
I would say no matter who you are and what you've been through, there is always hope with the right resources.
All right. Well, I'd like to thank you, Hillary Walker, Dr. Kathy Baldwin-Johnson from Alaska Cares, for joining us today for not an easy discussion, but a critically important one. So, and I'd like to thank everyone who joined us today on Line One, Your Health Connection. Thank you for listening. Join us next week. Prentice Pemberton will be back at 10 a.m. Dave Waldron produced today's program and was our sound engineer. Eric Bork is our web editor. This is Dr. J. Butler wishing you a healthy life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.